January the 10th, the 705th year since the foundation of Rome, the 49th before the birth of Christ. The sun had long set behind the Apennine Mountains. Lined up in full marching order, soldiers from the 13th Legion stood massed in the dark. Bitter the night may have been, but they were well used to extremes. For 8 years they had been following the governor of Gaul on campaign after bloody campaign, through snow, through summer heat, to the margins of the world. And now, returned from the barbarous wilds of the north, they found themselves poised on a very different frontier. Ahead of them flowed a narrow stream. And Tom Holland, if that very purple prose hasn't sent you to sleep, what was the name of that stream, pray tell?
Dominic, the name of that narrow stream was the Rubicon.
And who wrote those extraordinary lines, Tom?
Dominic, 'twas I.
It was. So that's the beginning of Tom's book, Rubicon. So that's the book that launched you as a historian, isn't it?
It's the first work of history that I wrote. In a way, my career as a historian
owes everything to those lines.
With those lines.
Extraordinarily, you're still working in history. And here we are.
Astonishing. Here we are going back to it.
And so we did the 12 days of Christmas over the festive season. And we were talking about anniversaries. And this is another anniversary, isn't it? Because January the 10th. Did it really happen on January the 10th, Tom?
Well, as with everything in ancient history, it's complex. I mean, this is the traditional date. It may have been a couple of days later. And it's further complicated by the incredible difficulty of mapping the Republican era dates onto our contemporary calendar. So right. By some reckonings, it may have been in late November, which
that's disappointing.
But let's just scrub that. So the 10th of January, Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon, and it is, I think, one of the great moments in world history. It's a moment of incredible drama, and the measure of that is that really, I think, ever since 17th century, maybe even 16th century, in English, the phrase to cross the Rubicon has meant to take an irreversible decision. And the reason that it has that resonance is that Caesar standing on the Rubicon is facing what the Romans called a discrimen. It's a moment of excruciating tension that is also a kind of dividing line in his career. Because what he essentially has to decide is, does he stand down his command? He's been governor of Gaul for almost 10 years. Does he have to lay down his command, go back to Rome, and risk prosecution and potentially the ruin of his career? Or does he stay at the head of his legions and cross the Rubicon, which is the river marks the boundary between his provinces of Gaul and Italy itself?
Yeah.
And for him to cross that river, let alone at the head of his legions, is essentially to declare civil war.
Okay.
So the decision could not be more massive.
So before we get into the decision, set the scene for us very, very broadly. We're in the Roman Republic.
Yeah.
In the first century BC.
Yeah.
So Rome is not yet an empire in name, but it kind of is an empire in fact, isn't it? I mean, it's acquired all this territory in sort of Asia and North Africa and so on. And the Republican system. So the picture you paint in your book, which has so many kind of contemporary resonances, doesn't it, with the kind of the American Republic and so on, that the picture you paint in your book is of this extraordinary city, kind of, you know, smoky, brick, disputatious, crowded, slum-infested city that has risen through military might to become the master of the Mediterranean. And it's sending out generals to the provinces and to the frontiers, commanding these armies who are increasingly unwilling to basically obey the conventions of the political. Is that a fair summary?
Essentially, yes. Essentially. I mean, the essence of the Republican system in Rome, it's founded, again, a bit like the American Republic. It's founded with the expulsion of the monarchy. And so the ideal in the Roman Republic, and Republic comes from res publica, it's the public affair. So the idea that it's male citizen, has a stake in the affairs of the running of the city. And the ideal essentially is that the Republic should give free rein to the talents of its people, and above all, their yearning for individual honour.
Yeah.
But that those yearnings for individual honour should be subordinated to the honour of the city itself and the Roman people as a collective. And so therefore, there's a kind of ferocious series of constitutional checks and balances that are designed to stop essentially a citizen from becoming overmighty, from making himself the equivalent of a king. And so those would include the division of the king's powers, for instance, between elected officials called consuls, who are, you know, there are two of them so that one can always keep an eye on the other. They only serve for 2 years. This is true of most of the lesser magistracies in the Republic as well. But it's also it's something that every individual citizen is raised up with a consciousness that kind of king is a dirty word. The word rex is a dirty word, and that properly your personal honor must be tied up with the honor of the collective. And this is a brilliantly effective system that enables Rome and the Romans to emerge essentially from being kind of bunch of cattle rustlers camped out on hills above marshes to, as you said, ruling the whole of the Mediterranean. The problem is with this, that the more powerful that Rome becomes, so the more opportunities there are for its individual citizens themselves to become powerful. And you end up in a situation where certain citizens at the absolute top of the tree of achievement are able to put the whole Republic in their shadow.
So this brings us to a question that we had from lots of listeners. Roy Neely, for example, and he says, What's so special about the Rubicon? So we're 49 BC, Caesar takes his troops across the Rubicon. Why is that? Because he's not the first overmighty individual, is he? Because you've had a civil war between two massive, titanic Roman figures a generation earlier, Gaius Marius and Lucius Cornelius Sulla. And Sulla had also marched on Rome, hadn't he? So why is that different from Caesar?
I mean, it's a good question. Essentially, Roman history in the first century BC is kind of structured around the personal rivalry of kind of charismatic populists and people who tend to identify themselves with the traditions.
It's this podcast.
The inheritance.
It's the balance of this podcast, Tom.
Yes, it is, if you like. You are the charismatic populist, and I'm the chilly, stiff, cold traditionalist.
I wasn't going to say that. I absolutely wasn't going to say that. I'm sure. I definitely thought of it the other way around.
So the last of these, obviously, is Mark Antony against Octavian, who becomes Augustus. Then you've got Julius Caesar, who's an absolute classic populist, against Pompey, who's also a populist, but ends up fighting for the kind of senatorial elite. And then right at the beginning, you have, these two figures, Marius and Sulla. And Marius is a populist. He's a great general. He's not aristocratic. The key thing that he does is that he faces up to the fact that the traditional days where, so a legion, what does a legion mean? A legion basically is a levy. And the idea is that a legio, a levy, is simply the Roman people in arms. And so everyone has heard of centurions. Centurions command centuries. But centuries are also the voting blocks within the Republic. So there's this idea that the army camp is simply a mirror of the forum, the Campus Martius, the Plain of Mars. You march out there and you get enrolled in the army and then you go off and fight. Then you come back and you resume civilian life. And this, for centuries, has been the way that it should organize. The problem is, again, that Rome has become too powerful, that it now, if you're being enrolled in a legion, you're being sent to serve in Spain or in Syria or whatever. And so it's impractical to imagine that you can just come back. And so rather than having a single legio, a single levy, you start to get multiple levies, multiple legions.
Yeah.
And Marius basically professionalizes it. And he says that it's unfair to expect, you know, peasants or whatever to go off and not be paid for this service. And so he, essentially, this kind of idea of a citizen militia, which is what the legio had been, becomes what we now think of as the Roman legions, and these become professional entities. And this makes Marius very popular, and he becomes consul a record number of times. But this generates opposition and envy. And the most charismatic figure who is envious of him is this guy called Sulla, who is a kind of louche, hadn't had a great, he hadn't had a meteoric rise, kind of hung out with drag queens and pimps and, in the red light district and all that kind of stuff. But turns out to be a brilliantly successful general and in due course an absolutely ruthless political operator. And what happens is that there's a kind of war in the East that promises all kinds of loot. It's going to be easy pickings. And Sulla gets the command for that. There are complicated political shenanigans in Rome that means he gets stripped of that command. Sulla has the legions ready to go. And rather than accept this, he marches on Rome. And Marius is forced to flee.
So if Sulla marches on Rome, isn't that a crossing the Rubicon type moment?
It kind of, yes, it
and
is.
And why don't we remember, why doesn't anybody care about that? Or do they? Did they care at the time?
They did care massively. It was an absolutely seismic event.
Right.
A completely seismic event, and it was absolutely felt to be that. Sulla then goes off to the east. He wins his war. Meanwhile, in Rome, there's been not just a civil war, but a war of the Italians in rebellion against the Romans. Sulla comes back. He embroils himself in that. He crushes the Italians. He crushes his opponents in the civil war. He establishes himself as the absolute master of Rome. And he dusts down this antique office, which is a very, very ancient one in the Republic. When the Republic is in absolutely desperate straits, you can appoint a single man for a 6-month term. And the name of this office is dictator.
Yeah.
So Sulla is appointed dictator for more than 6 months because he has the army at his back. He is absolutely ruthless towards his opponents. He has them. He has a whole bunch of them massacred in the heart of Rome. He then puts the price on people's heads. He posts prescription lists in the forum. People are paid if they bring him his enemies' heads. And it's an absolute rule of terror. And he uses his position of power essentially to enshrine the senatorial elite back in their kind of traditional role as arbiters of the state. So the Senate is, it literally means a kind of assembly of old men, the elders, the betters, the boni, they call themselves, the good guys. This is how they see themselves. And when Sulla does this, and the enemy, the people that he's targeting the populists. And so that's why there are kind of, so populares, and I think populist would be a legitimate way to describe it. The difference between them isn't so much about policy as it would be today, but about style.
Yeah.
And I think you absolutely see that's something that over the past few decades, the past few years, perhaps much more than when I wrote this, which was in the early kind of first years of the 21st century, that sense of how differences in style can kind of bleed into politics and generate incredible divisions seems much clearer. And one of the populists, and he's a very, very young at this point, is Julius Caesar, and he flees into exile. And for Caesar, that experience of having to hide out in barns, of being hunted across Italy, of knowing that there are people who will be paid if they can get his head.
And is that because he's very young though, Tom?
He's
so
very,
very
young.
Why has he been identified as a target by Sulla?
Well, he's related by marriage. He's married. His family have married into Marius's family. He's very much on the kind of the Marian side. He's very much on the populist side. And he identifies with that kind of side in this terrible schism. He survives it. Sulla and Caesar will express astonishment at this later in his career. Sulla lays down his powers. He retires to the Bay of Naples. He's basically kind of, he's recalibrated the Republic, the functioning, the plumbing of the Republic, so that basically his guys, his class of person will be in power.
And then he retires.
But he then lays it down. So Caesar is able to come back to Rome and to resume his career. But I think it has a the impact that that has on Caesar is that he's offended as an enthusiast for the Republican ideal of citizenship, that anyone could have done what Sulla did.
He's offended.
He's appalled by it.
The irony.
So right the way through his career, Caesar will be renowned for his clementia, his mercy. And there's something aristocratic about that. It's humiliating for a Roman to be shown clementia by another citizen. But there is another way of seeing that, which is that it's an expression of Caesar's feeling that there should properly be a kind of civic commonality.
Yeah.
And that to offend against that ultimately is to offend against the deepest ideals of the Roman Republic.
So he thinks politics has limits, basically.
I think so, yes. I think so. I mean, he's a very, very, very complex figure. But I think that you could say that through his career, he's motivated by two great ideals. One is that his own genius should have free reign. And that's a crucial part of it. You know, he absolutely feels that no limits should be set on his ability to achieve great things, both for himself, but also for Rome. But he does also have an incredibly strong sense of loyalty towards those of his fellow citizens who back him. And that, in due course, is why he will become a great military leader and why he will win the love of his soldiers.
So before we get back to Caesar, let's just paint a little bit more of the picture. Sulla retires.
Yeah.
And then Rome doesn't slip fully into dictatorship, does it? They basically go back to the old system.
It starts,
it's weakened, but they carry on as though it hadn't happened. And the big new sort of the Wunderkind, the young meteor, is Pompey, who's the sort of baby-faced, ruthless
teenage butcher. He's called
the teenage butcher. You called him that, didn't you? Or was that?
That's the name that he's given.
So he'd been one of Sulla's hitmen, basically. Had he? Is that fair?
Yeah. So he's a kind of a local bigwig in Eastern Italy, and he raises a private army, as does also another big hitter called Crassus.
Yeah.
And Pompey and Crassus both have meteoric careers in the wake of Sulla.
So they're kind of Sulla's boys, basically.
They're Sulla's boys. And basically, you know, Sulla has weighted it so that people who backed him are kind of in pole position to win advancement. Most of them do it in the traditional way, going up through the magistracies. Crassus does it by, he becomes incredibly wealthy. So one of his wheezes is that he employs Rome's only fire service. and he will then, you know, he'll kind of wait for buildings to be on fire and then charge the kind of hapless people money to put it out. And he'll then buy it up and build new blocks of flats everywhere.
That's very, dare I say, it's quite Trumpian behavior.
It's very, very Trumpian. But Crassus is a much kind of chillier, more controlled, more ruthless, more intelligent figure than say, Trump.
Okay.
Pompey is, so he models himself on Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
He has the quiff of Alexander the Great. He ends up sourcing what he claims is the cloak of Alexander the Great. Obviously, some guy in some Eastern bazaar has flogged it to him. But Alexander the Great is a kind of very ambivalent figure in Rome because he's a king and he's a conqueror and he's seen as being a tyrant. So Pompey's identification with him isn't entirely positive. And it's reflective of the fact that there are very kind of strict age thresholds in the Republic for when you can hold a magistracy. So most of the Romans absolutely adore middle age. So you become 40, you can run for consul. So it's great. I mean, you know, we become 40 and it's, oh God, I'm middle age. I'm so depressed, midlife crisis, get a motorbike. There you go. Brilliant. Now I can run for the consulship, which is why if you look at the portrait busts of Romans from the Republican era, they all look incredibly old, kind of crow's feet and baggy eyes and all that kind of stuff. But Pompey ignores that. And he just kind of gets as many commands as he can. And he ends up through a kind of complicated process being given command of basically the whole of the East. And the East is an absolute mess. The Romans haven't wanted to run it equally, they haven't wanted to allow anyone any of the kind of local kings or rulers to have any position of authority. So basically, it's all just collapsed into anarchy. So Pompey goes over there and he conquers the whole lot. And when he comes back to Rome, he brings kings in his wake. He's stupefyingly rich.
There's
He's
got all the plunder of the East.
He has this incredible triumph where in his triumph, they carry an enormous kind of bust of him complete with quiff, entirely modelled out of pearls. And it's kind of borne aloft so that everyone can see it. And this is magnificent, splendid. He's the hero of the hour. It redounds gloriously to the reputation of Rome. But it's also deeply, deeply offensive to people who see themselves as his peers. And one person who really detests it is Crassus, who has always been Pompey's great rival. So Pompey and Crassus, for instance, between them suppressed the rebellion of Spartacus, the great slave revolt.
Yeah.
Actually, it was Crassus who did it, but Pompey turns up and nicks the glory, which is kind of, he's a glory hogger. So Pompey finds, to his fury and disappointment, that even though he's by far the richest, you know, he's got this wealth, he's got this power, he's conquered half the East, people who he views as kind of worthless political schemers are getting together and are frustrating what he wants to do. And basically what he wants to do is he wants to provide land for his veterans and he wants the settlement of the East to be ratified.
Yeah.
And his enemies in the Senate refuse to do this. And this is classically how the Republic has functioned, is that if you are high achieving, then your enemies will gang up and form a consortium and kind of block you out. So Pompey is in a mess. And so he looks around for allies and he comes up with two allies. One of them is astonishing. One of them is Crassus.
So his arch enemy.
His
basically.
Arch enemy. But Crassus basically decides that the pleasure of hating Pompey has to come second to his own ambition.
Yeah.
So Crassus always puts ambition first.
So do you know what this is, Tom?
What?
This is one. This is 1997. It is John Redwood and Ken Clark teaming up in the Tory yes, leadership contest.
That's exactly what it is.
Against William Hague.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
I know it's a very niche reference, but about two listeners will be pleased by that.
No, that's exactly what it is. But they, and so they basically, what Crassus and Pompey are both going to do is essentially a kind of criminal operation to force through the measures that they both want that can only be done in a criminal way. And to do that, they need a consul who will force through the measures.
Sort of tame consul, basically.
Well, kind of a tame consul, but a consul who is willing to attract, to put up with the opprobrium that acting as their kind of agent will bring. And there's an obvious person, and that
who is it?
Julius Caesar. So Julius Caesar has, compared to Crassus and Pompey, had a much less a kind of successful career. He, again, has gone through the hoops. He's gone up the steps. There's a famous story that Caesar is in Spain and he goes to a temple and sees a statue of Alexander and weeps that Alexander had conquered the world and he has done nothing.
He should have read my book.
He didn't. That aspiring last paragraph.
Yeah.
So Caesar is very, very ambitious. He's very, very able. He's very, very popular. He's spent enormous amounts of money that he doesn't have on basically making himself pop. You know, he's the first person to stage gladiators dressed entirely in silver armor, for instance. These are despite the fact
so he's no a kind of he's a kind of political showman.
He's that's absolutely
what,
a political
that's
showman.
What he is.
Yes.
So is this to use another absolutely ridiculous modern comparison? Is he sort of slightly Boris Johnson in his Have I Got News For You?
Yes. I think again, obviously, any comparison with Julius Caesar and any political figure on the current British stage would be ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous.
But
he's a joke. He's not, he's not a joke.
He's not a joke. He's not a joke. So that's
but he's
the difference.
A crowd pleaser.
That's the difference. He's seen as being dangerous. So Sulla.
Right.
Sulla.
Yeah.
People had gone to him and said, look, pardon Caesar. And Sulla had said, there are a lot of Mariuses in that young man.
Okay. So people knew he was substantial. So
Sulla had seen that he was very, very able. And actually, he describes him as loosely belted. So Caesar wears his toga in a fashionably loose belted way. And he's a dandy. He does spectacular kind of... He borrows enormous amounts of money to build a villa. He then decides he doesn't like the villa, so he has the villa pulled down. And this is the kind of stunt that appalls lots of senators, but equally make, you know, it kind of appeals to lots of voters as well.
Well, when we did when we started our podcast, Tom, we had an episode. One of the very first episodes we did was about parallels. We were talking about Donald Trump in historical context, and you compared him to. I mean, the title of the podcast was "Is Trump Caesar or isn't that wasn't it? Is Trump Caesar or Nixon or something?" And you had this
something like that, wasn't it?
Thing about the Romans having this Roman politics having this role that people played, where they deliberately appalled the kind of the bien pensant, the great and the good,
for fun, yes,
in order to win popularity with the crowds, and that's what Caesar's doing from the start, pretty much, is it?
Yes, so I think, I mean, I'm sure I mentioned this in that episode, but I'll do it again. I think the closest parallel to what the Bonnie, the kind of classic senatorial elite, the people who will loathe and detest Caesar throughout his career, if you think of John McCain's funeral, where all the presidents apart from Trump went, and Democrats and Republicans were joined there in the kind of the front row to mourn this great hero. And Trump's comment on McCain was he didn't like losers. He liked his war heroes not to be captured, which is an appalling thing to say, particularly since Trump had never served. But it was also kind of darkly funny that people did find funny, because the kind of the shock of offending traditional norms was... So Caesar was never... I mean, Caesar was a great... He was incredibly able. He will turn out to be one of the greatest generals of all time. Yeah. He's a man of incredible ability, but he does have a talent for grabbing attention, for winning the popular vote, that perhaps there's just a kind of a hint of that there. He runs for consul and he wins it by a kind of massive, massive majority. And of course, he has a colleague, a guy called Bibulus, who is there to stand up for the interests of the Boni, the classic elite, but Caesar just elbows him aside. So people follow him around and tempt empty buckets of shit over Bibulus's head.
Oh dear, poor
and they
Bibulus.
Kind of they and when they try and oppose Caesar's measures that he's ramming through in favor of Pompey and Crassus, they get beaten up and they get forced out of the forum. And so people say that this is the consulship, not of Caesar and Bibulus, but of Julius and Caesar.
But at this point, Tom, is he very much the third man in the triumvirate?
Yes, he is.
When they start out. Yeah. And at that point, we had a couple of questions from people about Caesar and ambition. So Joshua D. Terry, for example, or Edward Habsburg, a man who knows, given his surname, a little bit about imperial power and the winning and losing of it. So they're asking... Is Caesar even at this stage? Does he have his eyes on the prize? Does he see himself as another Sulla, as a man who's going to wield supreme power? Or is he an opportunist seizing chances as they come up? And, you know, is it premeditated or not?
At this stage, I think there are two things going on in Caesar's mind. I think one is, as I said, that he wants to do great things.
Yeah.
But he wants to do great things for the Republic, for Rome. And he is frankly frustrated by the little guys who are trying to block him from that. He has a consciousness of his own genius and he wants the opportunity to fulfill that. I think also Caesar has looked at Pompey and has seen that basically if you get a command, the opportunities for... the opportunities that opens up to you will ultimately enable you to put the Republic in your shadow.
Yeah.
And Pompey is on a scale beyond everyone else. I mean, Pompey is criminal in his methods, but conformist in his ambitions. And so I think there's actually a question here from RP. Why did Pompey never do the equivalent of crossing the Rubicon when he was at the height of his powers? The reason he didn't do that was because ultimately he was in his heart a conservative. He'd trampled down convention to get to the top. But then having got to the top, what he really wanted was the approval of, you know, the senatorial
yeah.
elite. Pompey was a bit of a parvenu. He wanted to be accepted by them. Caesar didn't care about that. Caesar was, you know, Caesar claimed a line of descent from Venus. He could trace his ancestry all the way back, you know, beyond the beginning of the Rome to Troy. So Caesar had no hang-ups about that, and he wanted that license because he felt that he deserved it, but also because he felt that if he was going to be a great man in the Republic, it was no longer enough just to be a consul. You had to have a record of military success behind you, which would bring you legions who would be devoted to you. It would bring you the wealth that you could then spend on winning yourself popularity by kind of building, you know, spectacular architectural projects in Rome, or handing money out to the poor, or staging entertainments. And the only way to do that is for Caesar to get to command. Now, one of the things that his enemies had done before he becomes consul is to say, every consul, when he finishes his term of office, gets a kind of a posting. And they say, well, Caesar, as his posting, he can organize stuff in Italy. So basically, it's kind of, you know, he can be the head of the motorways agency or something like that.
Yeah.
And Caesar's not having any of that. So he basically, what Caesar does is he looks north, where there are various kind of provinces, one on the Cisalpine Gaul, on the Italian side of the Alps, the other Transalpine Gaul, which is a kind of the south of what's now France. And he says, I'll have those, please. And so he gets given those, and not just for 1 year, but for 5 years. And by getting that, he's in pole position to win himself the kind of power and authority and wealth and status that only Pompey has.
Perfect. Right, Tom, we're going to take a break now. We should go and work on our dice game, because come in handy later on. And we will be back after that. And Tom, we will be approaching the Rubicon, not a river, sadly, but just a piddling little stream, it turns out. Anyway, we'll see you after the break. Welcome back to The Rest is History. Julius Caesar has just got his command, the sort of long-anticipated command that he wanted to bring him wealth, fame, status, and power. So he's going off to Gaul to fight Asterix, Vercingetorix, and so on and so forth. And that's basically what happens, isn't it, Tom? I mean, Caesar claims that he kills a million people.
That's the report of Plutarch, writing a century or so later. He says over the course of the conquest of Gaul, Caesar slaughtered a million and enslaved another million.
So is this as true as the talking snakes in the story of Alexander the Great?
I think it's likely to be true. I mean, it's likely to derive from claims made by Caesar himself. Right. This was seen as kind of glorious, bloody feats.
Yeah.
Caesar's conquest of Gaul is completely illegal under Roman law. Actually, Caesar himself had brought in a law saying that that governors of provinces shouldn't go on kind of glory raids beyond the frontiers of their provinces. That's exactly what Caesar does. He crosses the Rhine. He famously crosses the Channel to Britain. It's an incredibly bloody, brutal, ultimately glorious process. And it brings Caesar exactly what he wants. Exactly what he wants. It makes him famous. He writes his own reports.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, isn't it the Churchill thing that history will be kind to me?
Because I intend to write it. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
So Caesar does that, his famous commentaries. So he makes sure that everyone back in Rome is kept abreast of his great feats, which he reports in a tone of kind of sober modesty, which is all the more effective for that.
Yeah.
And he starts to lavish money on the people, bribing high flyers in the Senate. He recruits large numbers of legions. So that the 13th Legion, which he'll take to the Rubicon, he's recruited that in, I think, 58, 57 BC, and it's followed him across Gaul. Now, all of this, of course, back in Rome, where large chunks of the Roman elite regard him rather as AC Grayling would regard Nigel Farage. I mean, that's the kind of that's how Caesar is hated,
right?
You know, it's how Remainers view Boris Johnson.
Yeah,
it's that level of hatred.
But hatred and fury at continued success,
and envy,
right?
And jealousy.
Yeah.
And of course, back in Rome, Pompey and Crassus still hate each other. So there's every prospect that the triumvirate will fall to pieces. It's not an official arrangement. It's a kind of shadowy, behind the scenes agreement of the kind that had always operated in Rome. It's just that these three men are so powerful that they really can basically run Rome as they want. But by 56, Pompey and Crassus are falling out, and a guy called Domitius Ahenobarbus, who comes from a kind of very distinguished senatorial family, he's a massive snob, detests Caesar, and he runs for the consulship on a ticket of cancelling Caesar's command. And so it looks as though everything is going to fall to pieces. Yeah. And Caesar can't have this. So he basically knocks the heads of Pompey and Crassus together. He meets up with them in a place called Lucca, a town which is just within his province. The triumvirate is reanimated. And by the terms of it, Pompey gets the province of Spain for 5 years. Crassus gets the province of Syria for 5 years. Caesar gets an extension of his command in Gaul for another 5 years.
Right.
So basically, those three men have divided up the most military significant provinces between them. So again, they are effectively impregnable. What then happens over the course of the following years is that that alliance falls to pieces.
Well, isn't that partly because it stops being a triumvirate and it becomes a duumvirate?
Yeah.
And so Crassus, he's basically thinking, isn't he, I'm going to become the big man because I'm going to win a victory that will make me utterly unassailable against the Parthians, who were the kind of, they're the inheritors of the Persian Empire, aren't they? And I know you'll enjoy telling everybody what happens to Crassus.
Well, so Crassus basically he's absorbed the same lesson that Caesar had, that you need conquests basically to be at the top table now in Rome. And so he gets Syria because he wants to use it as a base to attack the Parthians. It all goes horribly wrong. It's the first disastrous invasion of Iraq by a Western republic. So Crassus ends up beheaded, and it said either that molten gold is poured down his throat or his head is used as a prop in a Parthian.
Yeah. It becomes a sort of staging Christmas of a tree play. Bauble type thing.
Yes. Yeah.
But surely both those things are perfectly possible, Tom, aren't they?
Yeah, they are possible.
Pour the gold down first and then cut the head off, I'd say.
The story of gold being poured down the throat is one that pops up on a suspiciously large number of occasions in this period. So
right.
How accurate it is, I don't know. But that then, of course, means that one of the stools of the three-legged stool has been knocked. And a further disaster for the triumvirate, is now a duumvirate, is that Pompey had married Caesar's daughter Julia and had loved her very much. But in 54, Julia dies. So again, another kind of bond between the two men goes.
But Pompey is Caesar's elder, isn't he? Pompey is older.
No, Caesar's older, I think.
Oh, okay. So it's not really weird that Pompey has married Caesar's daughter.
No, but Pompey Pompey lays claim to being the first man, the princeps.
Yeah.
He's the top dog, and everyone basically accepts that. And Caesar essentially has accepted that, Pompey's primacy. But by 54, when Julia dies, and then 53, when Caesar's, he's trying to match Pompey up with another relative of his, and Pompey says no. It's becoming evident by that point that Pompey is starting to become a bit alarmed by Caesar's power and by the large number of legions that he has. Pompey, as the governor of Spain, has a large number of legions himself, but he stayed in Rome. So he doesn't have the close personal bond that Caesar has with his legions. And I said at the beginning about how for Caesar, the bonds of citizenship are, I think, incredibly important. And I think that what he finds in the army camp and his relationship with each of these legiones, each of these levies, is that he does respond to the idea of these legions as being, the republic in arms. And he comes to see himself as someone who has a truer understanding of what the bonds of citizenship should be than the kind of what he sees as the effete schemers in Rome.
Well, that is an interesting point, Tom, because a few people... So I mentioned Eduard Habsburg in the first half. He asked for our takes on Julius Caesar. He says, is he a ruthless, manipulating thug that brought down the Republic, or a brilliant soldier and lawgiver that saw the signs of the times? But you're suggesting there's a third option there, which is, I mean, that probably has elements of those two things, that Caesar is not trying, in his own mind, he's not really dismantling the Republic, but he sees himself as being truer to the spirit of the Republic because he thinks the Republic is incarnated by the army rather than the Senate. Is that right?
I don't think he'd do it quite like that. But, I mean, if you think of Cromwell discovering in the New Model Army,
yes,
kind of a truer representation of
England and godliness.
Of England than, say, the Parliament.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I think
there's kind of slight parallel there. And the idea that we have of legions as distinct entities, Caesar really is the guy who develops that. So the legions, the 13th Legion, for instance, that will be a distinct entity right the way up to the 5th century. It kind of briefly gets cashiered, but then it gets revived by in the civil wars under Octavian. These idea of legions as distinct entities with distinct loyalties to commanders, Caesar is the guy who really, really leverages that.
Yeah.
And Pompey has all the soldiers who followed him in the Middle East have been given their farms. So they've all gone away. So Pompey, in a way, is behind the speed with that.
But throw forward to the Rubicon, Tom. When Caesar is standing there at the edge of the Rubicon, and we will come back to that in greater detail later, does he think that Rome is with him because the men around him are the true Rome, and that the city beyond?
I think there's a huge part of that.
Because he doesn't think he's betraying Rome, or he thinks he's being true to the vision.
There's a question here. From Max Parker. Was there any chance that the army would refuse the order to cross the Rubicon? No, there wasn't, because Caesar would not even have contemplated it if that had been the case. And Caesar absolutely makes sure that the army are with him, the legions are with him. But I think that more than that, it's the fact that the legions are with him that gives Caesar the feeling that he has the right to do what he does.
Yeah.
That it's not just about his dignitas, which doesn't quite mean dignity. It's kind of his honor, his sense of worth, the due that he's owed for his achievements, but that the soldiers share in that. And they understand this better than the kind of do nothing politicians scheming and whining and scrapping and complaining back in Rome.
Yeah. So let's get back to the position in the years running up to the final schism. So clearly the tension is growing between Caesar and Pompey. And there's this, basically, as I understand it, what happens is that the end of Caesar's command is approaching.
Yeah.
And everybody knows this is going to be make or break, don't they? Because he's basically, presumably he's just terrified that he gives up his command, comes back to Rome, and he'll just get put on trial or something, or Absolutely. He'll get politically humiliated in some way that will stop him ever holding power again.
Well, the key thing is that as long as he has his command, he is immune from prosecution. So no one can prosecute him for, as his enemies see it, the crimes that he had committed during his consulship.
Right.
But they're all desperate. They're waiting for their chance to prosecute Caesar. So therefore, for Caesar, it's incredibly important that he maintains his immunity from prosecution by getting another magistracy when he ends his term of governorship. And so he wants to go straight from the governorship to a consulship. And so there's a tribune called Caelius who, in 52 BC, proposes that Caesar should have the right to run for election to the consulship while he's in Gaul. And the backdrop to this is that Caesar has just won the greatest, most extraordinary victory of his entire career, possibly in the whole of Roman military history, which is where he crushes a Gallic revolt, Alesia. And anyone who's read Asterix will remember Vercingetorix coming out and dropping his armor on Caesar's feet. That's how they portray it. And what happened at this is that Caesar is besieging Vercingetorix in this stronghold of Alesia, and Vercingetorix's Gauls outnumber Caesar's legions, but they're penned in. And then another relief army of Gauls comes. And so Caesar builds another series of fortifications to keep them out. So they're being attacked on both sides by two armies, both of which outnumber them. And somehow Caesar wins. Somehow he slaughters them all. And this essentially ends the Gallic revolt. Everyone back in Rome recognizes the astonishing scale of what Caesar's achieved. Even the Senate votes him 20 days of thanksgiving. And this is the backdrop where Caelius is able to say, okay, we think that, you know, Caesar's achievements are such that he should be allowed this immunity and to run for the consulship while he's in Gaul. Now, Caesar's enemies refuse to countenance this. They hate him so much. It's kind of, you know, It's A.C. Grayling, A.C. Grayling level of hatred for Johnson or for Raj or whatever. I mean, it's that.
So Boris Johnson has won this battle.
Yes, he's won. And Boris Johnson has. Yes, exactly.
And basically, liberal London is determined they will put him on trial regardless.
So there is no compromise, and essentially. It's fought over and fought over and fought over. And there is a kind of slight echoing of that kind of Brexit deadlock. So Caelius, the tribune who'd pushed that through, is a friend of Cicero, who's the great orator, whose letters and speeches are essentially our major source for this period. And Caelius writes to Caesar, to Cicero, you know the form, some decision will be reached about Gaul, then someone stands up and complains about it, then someone else stands up in turn, and so it drags on, a long, elaborate game.
Yeah.
And the horror of the situation is that no one can see a way, it's impossible to square the circle. And the person for whom this is a particular nightmare is Pompey, because Pompey doesn't want to have to choose. Because he doesn't want to have to alienate Caesar, particularly when Caesar is potentially so dangerous. But equally, he doesn't want to lose the respect of all his new chums in the Senate, who suddenly are backing him. And in 51, Pompey comes out against Caesar and says that he should lay down his command. And he specifically says that he is going to act like a father to Caesar. So that's incredibly offensive to Caesar.
Yeah.
You know, Pompey is laying claim to the rights of a father over Caesar, his own father-in-law. As
Tom, could Pompey have chosen differently? Could Pompey have thought, well, you know what? I don't want to risk civil war. I've basically got half the power. Done. I mean, that was his great mistake, was it? He just should have carved up power with Caesar and sold out the Senate, basically.
As it turned out, that would have worked out better for him.
Yeah.
But I think that the opportunity to, well, it wasn't just to pose as as the defender of the Constitution. I mean, he believed it, even though Pompey himself had engaged in endless kind of criminal, unconstitutional actions. At his heart, he wanted the approval of the constitutionalists. And so the chance ultimately to pose as the defender of the Constitution was too big an opportunity. And so, once Pompey has swung behind the constitutionalists, it means that no resolution is possible. So you go into 50 in December of 50 BC. One of the two consuls goes out to Pompey's villa in the Alban Hills outside Rome. And he takes a sword and he hands Pompey the sword. And he says, we charge you to march against Caesar, to defend the Republic. And Pompey takes the sword and says, I will do it if necessary. And that's when it becomes evident that, you know, there is going to be the most almighty bust up because now, you know, we talked about this before, 1st of January, consuls turn over, the tribunes turn over. Tribune in 49, comes in on the 1st of January, is one of Caesar's most decorated, most celebrated officers from Gaul, a man called Mark Antony. And so Mark Antony becomes tribune. He's Caesar's man in the Senate. And on the 1st of January, 49, Antony reads out a proposal in the Senate from Caesar that both Caesar and Pompey should lay down their commands simultaneously.
That's a pretty good compromise, isn't it? Why doesn't Pompey take it?
Well, the Senate decide that this might look too favourable, that, you know, they're so committed to destroying Caesar that they they think that that might make him look good, so they suppress it.
Idiots.
Which is, again, but you can see the kind of the Brexit echo that by pushing for total victory, they lose the chance to bank some winnings.
They go for the second referendum and it blows up in their face.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And so then they vote, they agree on a date by which Caesar has to give up his command, and that gets passed. Now, the role of a tribune, of course, the tribunes famously have the veto. A tribune can veto a measure. So Antony vetoes this measure. And the Senate, rather than accepting that, and, you know, this is the idea that they're constitutionalists. You know, they're perfectly happy to bend the constitution when it suits their needs. They declare a state of emergency. So 7th of January, they declare a state of emergency. Antony very, very flamboyantly disguises himself as a slave, as does Caelius, as does another Caesarian tribune. They kind of hide in a wagon and very ostentatiously head off to the frontier, to Ravenna.
How can you hide ostentatiously?
That's how they did it. It's all theatre. You know, they make sure that everyone knows.
In other words, right, okay. Yeah. So it's a performance, basically.
It's performative, I believe.
Right, yes, yeah. Very good. So they all...
And so they head off to Ravenna, which is where Caesar is, with the 13th Legion, waiting for news. And there's some confusion in the sources about when exactly the tribunes get to Caesar. Some say it's after the Rubicon, some say before. But indisputed, the news reaches Caesar in Ravenna, and, you know, he basically faces this excruciating decision.
Well, you say about the decision, but a few people have asked about this. So Nick R. says, what would have happened if Caesar hadn't crossed the Rubicon? John O. Henkert says, what was Caesar intending to do? There's this sort of... Mark Woodhouse says, was he ever not going to cross it? What were his other options? I mean, the way you presented it suggests to me that he's always going to cross it. Not least because...
Yeah.
Sulla has already done this, right? He's already marched on Rome. So Caesar, the crossing of the Rubicon is not such an unprecedented... Is it?
So there are various accounts of it. But one person who does not give an account of the crossing of the Rubicon is Caesar himself. So Caesar writes, you know, as he had written commentaries on his Gallic campaigns, he writes one on the Civil War as well. And the target, you know, he goes from Ravenna to a town called Arminium. And Caesar's comment on this is he set out with his legions to Arminium. There is no mention of the Rubicon. There's no mention of the fact that he's crossed it, that he's come into Italy. So you may wonder, well, where does all this stuff about him standing on the banks of the Rubicon and you know, wondering and pondering come from? And I think almost certainly it comes from a guy called Gaius Asinius Pollio, who was an officer with Caesar and with him on the banks of the Rubicon. He goes on to become a very significant cultural figure as well as political figure. So he's the patron of Virgil. He's a friend of Horace. He's a kind of Republican who stays true to that ideal right the way through his life. He kind of dies, I think, AD 4. But Pollio writes an account of this, and So Plutarch, who writes the biography of Caesar that gives the casualty figures in Gaul, he says that Caesar stands on the banks of the Rubicon and kind of ponders, and then he says, "Let the die be cast." He says this in Greek.
Okay, not in Latin.
No, so it's a quotation from Menander, "Anaritho kubos," let the die be thrown, let the die be cast.
Yeah.
Now, in Suetonius's account, this is translated into Latin as "Iacta alia est."
Yeah, that's the more famous. That's the most famous version, isn't it?
It is. But there's a question from Amy Mantravadi. Do we accept Erasmus's assertion that Caesar said, "Let the die be cast," and not "the die is cast"? And interestingly, I've been doing a translation of Suetonius for Penguin Classics. And the text I've been using, the Oxford Classical text, it has "iacta alia esto," which is "let the die be cast." So we don't, you know. Whether
he may not have said
"the die is cast" or "let the die be cast," I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter. And I think he probably did say it, because Pollio clearly remembered, you know, or Pollio is making it up.
I mean, doesn't he have this line, Tom? It's not, that's not all he says. Doesn't he also say, where is it? Let us follow where the omens of the gods and the evils of our foes will lead us, or something like that. Yes. Do you think he said that?
Well, we talked about the magic snakes, didn't we?
In
the context of Alexander. Okay, yes. Well, so I will I'll read you my translation of that passage.
Go
it's
for
in
it.
Suetonius. So according to Suetonius, the news has reached Caesar. He affects absolute lack of concern. He attends a public festival. He inspects the plans for a gladiator school. He hosts a dinner party. And then the sun sets. He harnesses mules from a nearby mill to his carriage, and he sets off in utmost secrecy with a kind of very small retinue, heading off to the banks of the Rubicon. But his torches blow out and he gets lost. So he blunders about until the sun starts to rise again in the east. He locates a guide, and this guide then takes him to the banks of the Rubicon. And he stands there, and Suetonius says that he says, even now we could turn back, but once we have crossed that tiny bridge, everything will have to be decided by war. And then, according to Suetonius, a wondrous thing happens. Nearby him, a figure of remarkable size and beauty abruptly appeared, sitting and playing on a pipe. And when some of his soldiers, trumpeters among them, abandoned their posts to join the large number of shepherds who had run to listen to the music, the apparition snatched a trumpet from one of the trumpeters, leapt into the river, sounded the advance with a mighty blast, and crossed over to the river bank. And that's when Caesar says, let us go where we are summoned, both by divinely authored signs and by the wrongs our foes have done us. Let the die be cast, or the die is cast, as you prefer.
Yeah.
So it's an incredibly dramatic moment. And Caesar crosses the Rubicon. Civil war ensues. Pompey is defeated. All the armies of Caesar's enemies are defeated. Caesar follows Sulla in making himself dictator. He ends up, unlike Sulla, who he says Sulla was an idiot for ever having laid down his dictatorship. Caesar is appointed dictator for life. And for this, he is assassinated by the people that he has pardoned and forgiven.
So his own Clementia?
Clementia, yeah.
Has come back to bite him because they feel humiliated by his pardons, don't they?
And the paradox of that is that Caesar pardons them because in that sense, he is a true Republican. He doesn't want to behave like Sulla. He doesn't want to execute people. He doesn't want to, pay bounty money for heads. And so the people he's pardoned murder him as the murderer of the Republic because they're able to, because Caesar had pardoned them for impeccably Republican reasons.
So do you think, Tom, that moment, so just one tiny detail. It would be an even more dramatic moment, wouldn't it, if the Rubicon was a better river than it is?
Yeah, it's a terrible river.
Because it's basically little more than it's just a stream, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so it's nobody was really sure which one it is. I guess we're still not entirely certain, but it's thought to be a river that I think until Mussolini, changed the name officially back to Rubicono, but it was the Fiumicino. And I remember going to look for it, and it's incredibly disappointing. It's very, very polluted. It kind of runs through industrial zones, and it's all snagged with cans and waste. It's called Rubio because that's it's kind of rusty red.
Yeah,
and it's kind of, even in ancient times, it had kind of iron deposits, turning it red. But now it's absolutely filthy, as I remember.
But do you think so? That to cross the Rubicon in sort of modern idiom means to take a decision that changes everything, after which there is no going back. Does it change everything though?
Because I think it does.
Do you think, but don't you think it, what follows is to some degree inevitable, the collapse of the Republican system and the rise of basically imperial dictatorship? Or do you think it took Caesar to make it happen?
I think that had Pompey swallowed his pride and negotiated a compact with Caesar, you could imagine a kind of duumvirate.
Yeah.
I mean, they may well have still have ended up fighting a civil war, but you could imagine, they wouldn't. Had Caesar's opponents been less obdurate, you can imagine him becoming consul and then kind of being embroiled back into the cut and thrust of Republican politics. So I don't think it was always inevitable. I think it's. I mean, I think it was always very, very likely. And I think that the reason that you asked why do we remember Caesar and not Sulla? Partly it's because Caesar's march on Rome is properly terminal for the Republic.
Yeah,
Caesar despises, you know, is not going to do what Sulla did. But I think it's also because you have that, you know, it's that physical idea of the river. And it's the idea that on one side of the river, you have the Republic and on the other, you have the Empire. You know, on one side, you have freedom and on the other, you have tyranny. Or as if you prefer, on one side, you have anarchy and chaos and on the other, you have order. And it's a kind of primal dividing line in what will become Western politics. And that's why it's remembered, because Rome does serve this primal role in the imagination of the West. It always has done. And the counterpointing of a republican system of government with an autocratic system of government, those are the kind of the great poles around which the Western political imagination has always revolved.
I think that's a really convincing argument, but it does raise one last question, which is Danny Kaye's question. This is such a dividing line in kind of Western political imagination, as you say, between order and anarchy, or between empire and freedom or whatever. But why is it Caesar who is so totally remembered, when the man who really incarnates that change is the man who ends up as his adopted heir, his great nephew, Octavian Augustus, who is the first? I mean, Caesar is not the first emperor. Augustus is. So why is it that we remember? I mean, everybody's heard of Julius Caesar. Even people who have no interest in history at all have heard of him. And probably even a lot of people who have no interest in history have heard of the crossing of the Rubicon. But people who have no interest in history often have not heard of Augustus at all, I would say. Why do you think that is?
Because Augustus veils his power. Augustus enters a compact with the Senate that the Senate will pretend to be more powerful than it is, and Augustus will pretend to be less powerful than he is. Caesar doesn't do that. Caesar is, in that sense, a republican. He wants his glory. He wants his dignitas. He wants his fame. And Caesar is a kind of... His powers are demonic and sublime, and he has these qualities of boldness, of dash, of perseverance, of a yearning to be the best, that in a way are it's the essence of what the Republic had always been and why the Republic had become the superpower that it did. And the subtitle of Rubicon, the book I wrote on this, is The Triumph and Tragedy of the Roman Republic.
It's a wonderful book, by the way. People who are listening should go out and buy it forthwith.
But the reason one way to define a tragedy is that qualities that under normal circumstances would be positive become negatives.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I suppose Caesar, he's a very republican figure, but he becomes a kind of cancer, I guess, within the body politic of the Republic, that all those qualities that had been working for the Republic turn against it.
Joe, we've got a podcast coming up on 1922, and he's like David Lloyd George. So Stanley Baldwin said of Lloyd George is a dynamic force, but a dynamic force is a terrible thing. And that's pretty much how the Romans think of Caesar, isn't it?
Yeah.
They recognize his qualities, but they think they're too much. He has to go. So, but Augustus is a greater politician, isn't he?
Yes. Augustus is incomparably a greater politician, but Caesar is a greater man. And if we're talking about greatness in that sense, and we are suspicious of greatness. We've talked about this so many times, but Caesar indisputably, if there is such a thing as a great man, Caesar was a great man. He was a great conqueror. He was a great political leader. He was brilliant at almost everything he touched. And I think there is something terrifying and, kind of demonic about it. And if we're talking about 1922, I'm sure W.B. Yeats, who becomes a senator in that year, Yeats wrote a brilliant poem about Caesar on the banks of the Rubicon. But civilization may not sink, its great battle lost. Quiet the dog, tether the pony to a distant post. Our master Caesar is in the tent where the maps are spread, his eyes fixed upon nothing, a hand upon his head, like a long-legged fly upon the stream, his mind moves upon silence. Augustus does not yeah. inspire that kind of poetry.
Oh, from Virgil, maybe, or Horace? Yeah,
maybe. Yeah,
anyway,
maybe.
Tom, I could listen to you talking about all this. I could actually listen to you for hours, but I recognise that people listen to this podcast while walking the dog or doing the dishes, and that nobody does the dishes for 3 hours. So we should probably, we will return to the end of the Roman Republic and the birth of the Roman Empire in future podcasts. We have so many plans for podcasts about the Romans. But our path leads us later this week to 1922. And thank you very much, Tom. We will see you all in 1922 next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.